if he only serves from some secondary motive, giving a day to some hospital or something of that kind because it's done, this is not the answer. The instinct to serve is a spiritual truth within man. And it comes out in the most unusual ways. There are many cases where a perfect stranger has given his life to save another one who is in great danger. No known reason. He didn't have to do it. But at the moment of a great catastrophe for another, his own inner life took over. And he was able to make this important sacrifice. A sacrifice which was perhaps the best thing he ever did. But it is to get at this level inside of ourselves that we must all labor to the very best of our ability. Another aspect of the same problem is the effort of the individual to resolve certain uncertainties in his own heart and mind. Most persons, unconditioned by ulterior or non-factual pressures, believes in deity. Even those who may consciously and intellectually deny it because of the sophistication of their environment, still in their heart and soul believe. They believe there is a divine providence. They believe that there is a deity at the source of life. And for most who believe this, there is also a belief that this deity is operating through humanity on the level of human beings, and that the power of this deity is centered in the heart of every creature that has the physical structure to have this occur. And in other forms of life, this deity is present very often in the magnetic field because there is not enough organization for it to enter in and dominate. But everything in the world is dominated by this divine being. It is the power of life in us. Without it, we cannot breathe. And without using it, we cannot live correctly. It is this problem of getting at what life wants of us instead of the eternal cry of what do we want from life. Our wants are limitless. But the wants of life itself are few. And the most important want or desire of life is to express its own purpose. And its own purpose is the highest purpose that any human being can conceive of. So we have the right to gradually work toward the recognition of a purposeful background for ourselves. We are here to prove that we are growing. We are not here to make all the mistakes we made over a period of 100,000 years. We are not here because we died on the battlefield of Troy. We are not here because we fought the great war of the Mahabharata. We are here because it is assumed that from previous lives we have learned something and therefore are capable of living above the level of previous existences. Yet in our general appearance as we go along through, it does not seem that humanity has learned this. It does not seem that we are really aware that it is not foreordained and predestined that we make the same mistakes we always made. In a sense, to make a mistake is a rare individual privilege that we can't afford. But actually, we keep on making the mistakes. And why? Look it into ourselves. I know a great many people who are quite nominally religious. They believe in religion. They believe in God. They worship their various saints and sages with real devotion. But when temptation comes along, they fall. The one told me once that God would have to overlook a few of these idiosyncrasies. It might be that if God sat on a throne in the heavens, he wouldn't notice some of them. But unfortunately, God is inside of us. It is a divine principle that knows everything about us while we know nothing about it. So there is no avoiding. The damage is done to the psychic integration. The damage is done to the development of internal character. The compromises that we make are scar tissue in our soul fabric. There is no possible way of avoiding it. So it is up to the person not only to be a nominal believer in something, or to accept the idea that he should do better than he does. The great problem is that he must do better than he does, or else he will remain as he is. If he remains as he is, he will be worried to death over every political crisis that arises in international affairs. If he remains as he is, he will worry about high taxes, and he will worry about inflation and depression. If he continues as he is, he will have great anxieties about nuclear fission. He will recognize only the deficiencies in our various energy resources. He will live in an emergency until the emergency closes over him and actually destroys his body by exhaustion. If he continues as he is, he will continue to have exactly the same anxieties. Yet, if you look around a little, and I've done a little looking, you will find there are a great many people today who do not have these anxieties. Now, there are two kinds of people involved. One is the childlike person who has not yet accepted the reality of the illusion. And the other is the very wise person who has outgrown the error of illusion. These two, one through innocence and the other through virtue, have attained liberation. The small child doesn't know enough to worry. The older, wiser person has recognized the operation of a universal principle, has accepted it, and is trying to live in harmony with it, fully aware that nothing that is real can ever be destroyed, and that nothing that is unreal can ever be preserved. In the ecology around us in life, we perceive definitely how human abuse is gradually exhausting natural resources. We know that as long as the abuse continues, the resource will become more scarce. But this is actually part of the growing process, to discover these things, to accept them, to know they are true, and to live according to them is what we are here to accomplish. And the more that we accomplish in this way, the more we adjust to a larger vision of life. In a comparatively short time, we will depart from this uncertainty and for a time at least be no longer directly associated with the causes of our anxieties. But if we haven't solved them, we will be born again as people with anxieties. We might live in a completely utopian sphere at that time and be just as miserable as we are now. The individual who is miserable today will remain miserable until he solves the mystery of misery within himself, until he is able to build an acceptance of the plan of things and cooperate with it. If in the course of this life we do accomplish something that is really good, it may manifest a little bit right here now. And people who have at the moment very little incentive will find new objectives and new reasons for existence. We'll find that life is something more than trying to endure the passing of years with the full realization they're going to end one of these days. This is not life. This is not purpose. The individual will waste time so it'll pass more quickly, doesn't realize it, but he lives in a universe in which there is enough time for him to continue to make this mistake as long as he wishes to. But he will not win. In the long run, nature achieves. Because nature has put into every cell the secret of its own salvation. It has put into the individual every faculty and power necessary for him to achieve liberation from the delusions and illusions of an unreasonable life. He is here essentially surrounded by a series of social disciplines also. And if he is unable to learn directly from his own inner core, he is perhaps able to learn through the experience of his own conduct. This is one way in which we understand nature. We know what nature wants largely by discovering what it does not want and learning from experience. But experience is always with us in the physical world. We are surrounded by problem after problem, and there are many clinical answers to many of these problems. If you go to a qualified psychologist or psychiatrist with a heap of worries, he will probably very quickly remark or bring to light the fact that you are suffering from a wrong mental attitude. And if later this wrong mental attitude begins to interfere with the function of the body itself, your physician, realizing that your mind is wrecking your body, will send you back to some psychologist and tell him to clear it up. The individual, however, with all this complex and quite a little expense thrown in as a special inducement, because there's nothing at the present time, apparently, that comes closer to sincerity than the loss of money. The individual could learn very simply. He looks at himself and he finds out that he's been nursing all kinds of destructive attitudes until finally he is sick. And if he nurses them long enough, he will be sick. And if he does nothing about it after he gets sick, he will probably die. And he will die of his own attitudes, which have been allowed to become chronic. Now, he could have learned something from this. A few do. Many do not. Others feel that when they have this kind of a problem come on, the answer is to medicate for it, to take all kinds of sedations and tranquilizers and things of this kind in order to control a disposition that needs to be disciplined from within the individual himself. The only way in which you can get over a dispositional peculiarity is to change yourself. Because if you die with that psychotic situation, you will be where you can't get the pills, but the ailment will linger on. You're not going to get rid of it. So in the end, you have to live with yourself. And nature says, let's make it compatible. Let's live in a way in which you can be comparatively happy, comfortable, and well-adjusted. All this means that we have to gradually take hold of our own lives. We have to do something to break through not a complacency, but a sense of helplessness, or the simple sense of not recognizing the problems at all, just not knowing they exist, but knowing very clearly the troubles that they cause do exist. Actually, to gain gradually a certain insight can be a very inspiring and wonderful experience. If we suddenly realize that there isn't anyone who hasn't got a job in nature, that everyone here is capable of useful cooperation with the plan of life, and that we all have the right and privilege to grow and are here for that purpose, we can build our lives more and more around the concept of growth instead of the concept of futility. No individual needs to sit around doing nothing. If he is doing nothing, this is not leisure. This is just simply a strange loneliness in a universe that is made up entirely of life. The person who has no interest in life is dead while yet he lives. But those who have great interest in life, though they die, live forever. It is a matter of bringing out a simple fact that we are a creature of law, that we are fashioned according to a plan, that this plan exists forever as an archetype in the divine mind, that we are the products of a purposeful pattern, and that the deity that fashioned us has appointed us to be the agents of that deity in the perfection of an order of living things. Now, there may be many orders of living things in space, but our order we likely call humanity. And humanity is not merely 4.5 billion people. Humanity is one entity. Humanity is an order of life. And it is part of the plan of things that humanity shall become perfected. That everything that was implanted in humanity as a potential, as a beneficial power given by deity, shall be brought forth to fruition. That it shall bear fruit according to its kind. And that from this gradual cooperation, this gradual mingling of purposes and motives on a constructive level, humanity as an entity, as a simple being, collective, will come into its inheritance, that it will fulfill the purpose for itself. When this occurs, then the entities that are here will have cooperated and will have graduated from this particular grade in the school of creation. Humanity may be in the first year of high school, or it may be the post-kindergarten. But whichever it is, we graduate when we outgrow that particular type of condition. And we outgrow it only by mastering it. We can never outgrow it by voting it out or trying to evade it. No government can take care of people who cannot take care of themselves. They have to gradually be taught to use the resources with which they have been endowed. Now, in our way of life, there's also a great misunderstanding as to what constitutes a good life. To many people, a good life is an opulent life. It is a life of leisure. It is a life of extravagance. It is a life of being able to do exactly what you please, whether what you please is good or not. Therefore, all of the ambitions of the race are directed towards a superior social state. This in itself, of course, is related to karma. But who is to judge the karma? Perhaps this so-called exalted state is more or less an examination, a test. We have at some time or other earned a greater degree of security than some others have earned. So it's given to us. And having been given to us, we promptly abuse it. Therefore, we lose it again. You can never abuse anything into a permanent possession. Consequently, it is a kind of testing. Perhaps we have, through virtuous action, gained the right to certain benefits. In other words, good karma moves in on reincarnation. And the person who has done a good deed is the recipient of a good deed. And if we have achieved a certain management over lesser things, we will be given power over greater things. So it comes. And the moment we get the power over greater things, we proceed to forget our principles and abuse that power. Then, as Buddha says, who came and walked as a king will come back as a beggar, for things done and things undone. Therefore, there is no security in physical estate, nor is there any deficiency in the lack of it. It is very possible that the greatest growth will be done by people who will never even be aware of that growth as far as this life is concerned. They will be people you will never hear of, but people who conscientiously and with dedication try to fulfill the proper and reasonable responsibilities of life. By so doing, they contribute to the release of their own inner soul power. And as Gandhi once said, the great victory is the victory of soul power over brute force. Wherever we are self-centered and selfish, we belong to a level of brute function. But when we transform or transmute all the energies that we have into soul power, then we begin to live not for ourselves, but for the good of others. Gradually, by degrees, we recognize opportunities to serve. We become involved in patterns and circumstances that are a permanent good to others. And as in the case of most of the great teachers of the world, we become martyrs to the needs of others. All of these are part of a good preparation for the future. We are going to grow. We are going to fulfill the proper destiny which was assigned to us. As we grow in this way, we will find that a great archetypal pattern, Jamie speaks about these patterns, there is an archetypal pattern of humanity. It is a magnificent radiant star, a magnificent living light. And what the human being is attempting to do with all others of his kind is to fulfill this archetype, to bring it into perfect incarnation in the structure of humanity itself. It is this pattern of the perfect humanity that the divine mind projected at the very beginning. We are here to be ye perfect. And to be perfect, the individual has to perfect his own nature. The problem of perfecting is, however, not, according to nature itself, difficult. And most persons in what they would might consider a better environment would do much better than they do now. But the great victory is the victory of self over circumstance. This is the sign of strength. In the ancient mysteries, the neophytes for initiation, the candidates, were tested even to the degree of physical danger. They occasionally were killed in the initiation rites because of the severity of them. Now, these rites no longer exist in the world. Many people are glad they do not. But others have also noticed with some thoughtfulness that these testings now go on the level of society. A lot of us lose our lives in attempting to achieve victory over the lower self. Everywhere there is testing, everywhere there is crisis, and only those who gradually perfect their own natures come finally to become custodians of the larger truths, to become aware in substance and certainty that which the rest of us must dream about and hope for. But the testing of the individual is inevitable. Therefore, in this time, we are really very fortunate people. We don't really think so much of that at the present time, but actually a crisis such as we are in is definitely an initiation. It is a test, and each individual is going to react according to what he is. And each individual should note carefully his natural reaction. He should note whether or not this situation is bringing out something of his own higher understanding, or whether it is merely making him irritable and frightened. If he has no resource within himself to face change, then he should begin to search inside of himself very assiduously. He must find the victory of his own inner insight over the pressure of society. If enough people do this, of course, the social problem would be solved. But in time, enough individuals will gradually assemble so that the problems will instinctively fade away. But this will not probably be in one life or even a dozen lives. But ultimately, the changes in human reaction will result in the transformation of social structures. Society will emerge as a composite structure of a proper nature and purpose, as more and more individuals live for what they give and not for what they get. The Reformation, the Universal Reformation, begins in man and must continue in man until the work is finished. So we say again, try occasionally to imagine, to visualize more or less what you would have done with your life if you could have lived it exactly according to your perhaps childhood hopes, the dreams that you had in the beginning, which were merely perhaps dramatized fairy tales. But actually the fairy tale is an archetypal dream, and in the long run we are all going to live together forever in happiness. But it's a long way off for the majority. But in this fairy tale life, think back to what you would have been before ambition got you, before the pressures of other people affected you, before your dreams were blighted. What did you want to be? What kind of a person did you want to be? And in your early teens, before you got set in too heavy an educational pattern, what would you have liked to do with your life? What kind of a career would you have chosen if the economic factor had not existed? If it hadn't been a problem of earning a living, what would you have preferred to do? If you're one of those people who perhaps would have preferred to do nothing, then you better take on the responsibilities of the moment. But if you already had dreams, and they were blighted, and there were instincts to creativity, I know people in middle late life who are writing very beautiful poetry. Poetry seems to be one opening that comes through. Sometimes an individual has had a poetic instinct all their lives and never actually wrote four verses until they were over 60. But it's there. Others find, as the responsibilities of raising children and things of this nature, that the old dreams come back, that there was something they always wanted to do. Some of them wanted to travel. Some of them wanted to teach. Some wanted to go into religious life. Others wanted to complete imperfect or interrupted careers. But everyone wanted to do something. And when they do that something, nearly always there's little or no satisfaction unless that something they want to do is a common service. It is something they want to share. The poet wants to share his innermost feelings with anyone who will read his poetry. The actor wants to share his reactions to the drama that he participates in. Everyone would like to have a field of expression, an expression that is worthwhile. Now, this expression may be censored by a lifetime of frustration. And it may be that by the time we get around to it, some of the edge and ambitions of our inner lives have become quieted. But everyone can do something. Everyone can make some kind of a creative contribution. Perhaps no one will ever know about it but you. But if you do it, not merely talk about it, but do it, you will find that there is a great release within yourself. An individual who can develop a good creative outlet will probably never need psychological or psychiatric care. They will release from themselves, and everything that we release from these little plants, which we call our personalities, will either be flowers or fruit. And the flowers represent the simple expression of the beauty in ourselves. And the fruit represents the contribution we make to the common survival. These things can help us, but we must come to the conclusion that deity in its infinite wisdom was not interested in creating a lazy creation. It didn't want to make a world of people trying to escape responsibility and hoping to cut down working hours till they do not do anything at all. This is not the divine plan. And if we frustrate this divine plan enough, the punishments will get heavier and heavier. But we are going to change, and we're going to learn before we get through. So the easiest and the most purposeful thing is to learn now, to get started at it, to do the things that we have within ourselves. Go into your own depth and find out what's there that you could use to make a more beautiful life. that you could also find ways of sharing life, getting over prejudices. One problem, of course, is that the prejudiced person nearly always carries many years of irritation or disillusionment or anxiety over things that may have happened so long ago that everyone else has forgotten them. But prejudice is not beautiful. Prejudice doesn't help. It only locks the individual in negatives. And it closes to the mind that is prejudiced all the beauties of the area in which that prejudice controls. If we are prejudiced against people, if we are prejudiced against arts or crafts or of religions or races or anything of this nature, we are simply cutting off part of that one glory of life which we should understand, should accept, and should be able to use in the development and maturing of our own consciousness. Clearing up prejudice, opinions, getting over old grudges, do anything possible to take false pressures off of your own subjective life. For it is only when the false pressures go or cease that the true pressure of the divine life within can come through. It is only possible to move from the inside out when we stop cramming everything from the outside in. As long as we build our entire life upon outside circumstances, the inner life has no chance. It goes along until we depart from here, and in due time it comes back with another body. But unless we allow it to speak, we will never know what our real destiny is, and we will be pushed about by the common attitudes of unenlightened persons. But even these unenlightened persons are growing also. Everything is growing. It is a magnificent unfoldment. But it exists on many levels. And each individual must try to function on the highest level available to his own consciousness. And at the same time that he is doing this, realize that the higher his level of consciousness is, the more perfectly he will understand all whose consciousness is less than his own. That which is above always understands all of that which is below, because it cannot get to the above without passing through the below. And in the basic subjective of the entity, all conditions of achievement less than our present level exist. And by calling upon our inner life, we develop a great sympathy for the lesser. And instead of looking down on it, we regard it as a parent might regard children. As Pythagoras very wisely observed, there are only three relationships in life. He said, there are those who are wiser than we are, and they are our parents, regardless of whether they have any blood relationship or not. Then there are those whose knowledge and wisdom is equal to our own. They are our brothers and sisters, and we exist with them in perfect equity. And there are then those also whose knowledge is less than our own. They are our children, regardless of whether they're related to us or not. They are our children, and we shall instruct them. So there are no other relations in life. And the individual who has the proper outlook or in-look upon life will realize that it is one very beautiful picture, a wonderful, sensitive, sympathetic situation in which we are all bound together by the strongest possible ties and separated by the weakest possible separative factors. As we gain the more understanding and sympathy for this, I think we will find more of our place in the plan and how to cooperate with the divine purpose. Well, I guess that's all for this morning, folks. Now, I've got an announcement I'd like to make. I have a little announcement I'd like to make. It's a very disturbing and discouraging announcement, no doubt, but I'm going on vacation. I've had about 5 vacations in the last 40 years and spent 3 of them in the hospital. So So this time I'm going out, and I'm going to do something very rugged. I'm going to rest. So for the month of August, I won't be with you. And during that month, John Irwin, a friend of 40 years, who is the now succeeded Dr. Drake as vice president of the society, is going to take the Sunday morning sermons or discussions. He is a very well-equipped man. He is profoundly concerned over the Jungian system of psychoanalysis. He has widely experienced in religion and also in law. And I think that you will find that he has many very interesting things to talk about, and I hope you will give him a good attention on the Sunday mornings while I am out taking it easy. In the meantime, don't forget to visit the bookshop and the various activities we have here, and I hope that you will be present each Sunday and during the month of August, because I'm sure you will find John Irwin's material highly accurate and very thoughtfully presented. So we wish for him a successful month while I am on vacation. Thank you very kindly. Thank you.